Dear listeners, hello and thank you for joining us for this 243rd edition of Sudbury News Talk magazine. My name is Michelle Mandry and I will be your presenter today. Well, the year has turned to autumn once more and children have returned to school. The start of the school year has always felt to me like a new beginning. A throwback to my school days, of course, but also the sense of a year completed as the harvest is in, the topic for this edition, and Harvest Festival is just around the corner. Most of us are only a handful of generations away from the land, and here, with a poignant reminiscence of that connection, is a piece by Margaret Hibble, read by me. When I saw that this month's topic was harvest, I immediately thought of my grandfather and his connection to the harvest. My grandfather was born in 1872 in Peasenhall, a village in Suffolk close to Saxmundham. Peasenhall is a small village with a present-day population of just over 500 residents. It was, and still is, famous for Emmett's store. Emmett's is the oldest artisan ham and bacon producer in the country. The family still operate from the same premises which was established in 1820. They held a royal warrant for over 30 years and have been mentioned by several famous chefs. Their bacon and ham is still cured in the original smokehouse. Back to Grandad. He was one of nine children living in a small cottage close to Peasenhall Mill. That side of my family were farmers and millers by the name of Cole. Peasenhall Mill was a wind-powered post mill used by my family to grind the corn that they grew on their farm. A lot of windmills fell into disrepair with the advent of steam engine and later electricity. I'm not sure when Peasenhall Mill stopped operating, but I certainly remember it still being used in the 1950s. I remember the mill with its large round grain store at the bottom and the large wooden sails which worked the mill by rotating the wheels which ground the corn. As children, we were allowed to play in the bottom part of the mill, but we were never allowed to climb the rickety ladder to the next floor. It was deemed to be far too dangerous. My grandfather eventually married and moved to Sudbury, finally settling with his wife and seven children in Girling Street, in the house where many years later I was born. Finally, I come to my link with harvest. Every year, when harvest time came around, my grandfather, who by now was living with my mother, father and myself, incidentally in the same house in Girling Street, would go to Peasenhall to help with the harvest. His job was to follow the combine and catch the rabbits. At this time of year, rabbit pie was a real treat and an economical way of feeding a hungry family. After a couple of weeks, he would come home bringing a couple of rabbits with him. I can still remember the flavour of that rabbit stew. Thank you, Margaret. What lovely memories of family and old country ways. John King is here now, taking a look back to the harvests of his youth.
Living in the east of England, the word harvest evokes grain harvests. The brain brings into mind pictures of golden fields being cut, threshold, threshed and winnowed to produce, hopefully, enough grain to feed many people and animals, also to produce beers and their distilled offspring. Today, on most farms, the process is carried out by very few workers equipped with combine harvesters of various sizes. Some are truly enormous and so heavy they are track-lying like tanks. When I was young, the system was much more labour-intensive, as there were no combine harvesters. The grain varieties had longer stems and were cut by a machine called binder. The binder was hauled by a tractor and would cut the corn or wheat and bundle it in, tie it up and eject it into the field. The field soon filled with these bundles called sheaves. As the binder made its progress, farm workers would then stack the sheaves into stooks, about six sheaves to the stook. The stooks would stay in the field to dry and finish ripening, as the crop was cut greener then, day after day. When the drying was complete, the sheaves were all collected by using pitchforks to toss them into tractor trailers. They were all taken to the threshing machine, and there they were pitched into the thresher hopper. The thresher was a terrifying, noisy machine with pulleys and belts and whizzing round. The result of all this activity was the grain coming out from one part and straw from another. Of course, the machine had blowers to remove the chaff, which would fill the air with dust, just as the combine harvester does now. The straw was piled into stacks for later use by animals. The thresher was powered by the tractor, but in earlier times, it was a steam engine. It hardly bears thinking of steam engines with their coal-fired fires juxtaposition to the bone-dry straw. You can quickly see how labour-intensive the process was, and at the start of the 20th century, scythes were still in use. They haven't replaced the sickle. All of the changes, of course, were only made possible by the invention of the internal combustion engine. Other crops have similarly changed, either by mechanisation or the use of chemicals. Think beet hoeing. I feel it would be remiss not to acknowledge the many other harvests in Britain, Europe and around the world. Sugar beet, sugar cane, potatoes, soft fruit, stone fruit, apples, pears and so on. I will end with a nod to the Mediterranean. I love olives, and I love the Mediterranean and the Adriatic and the Greek islands. So the old gnarled olive trees, along with their younger relatives, being surrounded by ground nets and then shook free of their gorgeous crop, whilst pickers pluck off the many stubborn fruit, is an appealing thought. Of course, harvesting is all very hard work, and all farmers are at the mercy of the weather, and is not always kind by any means. This year, lack of water and heat have done many a farmer and their crops no favours at all, harvest down by at least 25%. So, all set for drilling, spraying, and another year rolls on.
Thank you, John, for such a vivid account. I know the early machinery was intended to speed things up and reduce the need for labour and make things easier. But it sounds like really hard graft to me and a real assault on the senses. So I feel for those people. Now, though, I am really delighted to introduce our guest for this harvest edition, local farmer John Pawsey. John wasn't able to join us in the studio today, but has recorded an item for us. I'll let John introduce himself.
Hello, my name is John Pawsey and I'm a farmer from Shimpling Park Farm. That's the Shimpling that's about 8 miles south of Bury St Edmunds. And I started farming here in 1985 and took over from my maternal grandfather. He was a man called David Alston, A-L-S-T-O-N, and there's Alstons in Suffolk. But in fact, my family came from Ayrshire in Scotland. And they came down to initially rent land in Suffolk in the late 1800s, about 1890, 1895. And they initially rented land in Essex, but eventually bought farms in Suffolk. But most Alstons actually now, who came from Scotland, farm in Norfolk. We bought our first farm in 1908, and I still farm that farm today. When I first came back to farm, we farmed in a very conventional way, and I did all the spraying on the farm. And there was a day in, you know, the late 1980s when I was spraying, and a hare got up in front of the sprayer, ran in front of the spray, and then doubled back and went underneath the spray and got sprayed and then sat on the headland and started licking itself. And I just really worried about all the chemicals that we were spraying on our fields at that time. And I decided that I didn't want to do that anymore. So I was very lucky to have a neighbour called Ben Pole who lived at Horsted. And he'd been farming organically, so without chemicals, since the 1970s. And I went and saw Ben And he really gave me all the tools I needed to dip a toe into organic farming, because of course it's very different to conventional farming, when all your solutions to your problems with weeds and pests and diseases can come straight out of a chemical bottle. But when you farm organically, you have to really think out of the box and work with nature rather than against it. And we converted our first farm in 1999. And so we've now been farming organically for 25 years, which is amazing. I have to say, I can't believe that we're still doing it. But anyway, a little bit about harvest. When we were farming non-organically, we basically grew a very narrow range of crops. Those crops really being wheat, some sugar beet and some oilseed rape. But farming organically, you have to have a really sustainable rotation because we're not using any artificial fertilizers. So the main bit of our rotation is a nitrogen fixing, a leguminous, something that contains legumes that fix nitrogen from the atmosphere, because nitrogen is one of the main components for crop growth. And so we have a year or two of just growing lots of clovers and building that soil fertility and building our soil organic matter. And then after that, we have growth three crops. The first crop generally being a winter cereal, which is sown in the autumn. And that can be a heritage wheat. It can be a modern wheat. It can be spelt. And then after that, we put in a spring crop, which is generally malting barley. And we alternate between winter and spring crops, because what we're trying to do is make a diverse rotation so no one sort of problem dominates. So we don't select a whole load of autumn weeds or a whole load of autumn pests. We spread it between different seasons. After that, we then have a legume again, because we need to fix a little bit more nitrogen. So that could be anything from peas to beans, and we've even grown lentils in the past. And then after that, the last crop in the rotation is another spring crop, which is normally spring milling oats, which then go to make breakfast cereals. So they were the basic crops we have on the farm. We do have lots of other little bits and pieces. We've grown chia in the past. We've grown quinoa. We've grown vetches for seed as well. But they're the main staples in our rotation. So this year, because of the drought, we've had our spring crops didn't do terribly well at harvest 2025, but our winter crops did really well. And in fact, we had some record yields, which was really encouraging, certainly on our wheat crops and our oat crops. The spring crops, which were oats and barley, didn't do so well, but actually they didn't do badly either. And I think that what we're going to end up with is an average harvest. And with the kind of weather we've had this spring, which has been really variable, is, I think, an average is something to be pretty pleased with. So our crops go to various different people. So our wheat this year is going to go to a mill in Wiltshire at Shipton. Our oats all go to White's Oats in Northern Ireland to make lovely breakfast cereals. And our beans go to feed organic animals. And our barley goes to make organic beer. All in all, I've really enjoyed our organic journey over the last 25 years. I'm 61 this year. I'm about to hand over to my children, which I'm really looking forward to doing. But all in all, harvest this year for us has been average. And given the weather, as I said before, I think we can be pleased with that. Do come and visit us at Shimpling Park Farm. If you Google us, you can find our website. We do have events. But anyway, it's been great just summarising my organic journey and Harvest 2025. And I wish you all a very, very merry autumn.
Many thanks to John for giving us an insight into what Shimpling Park Farm does and how the switch to organic came about. It was also good to know where the produce goes to once harvested. And may we wish you a long and satisfying retirement. And now this month's quiz is brought to us by a new voice and fantastic quizmaster Ian Etherton.
Question number one. What is the capital city of Finland? What is the capital city of Finland? Question number two. What sport does Ben Stokes play for England? What sport does Ben Stokes play for England? Question number three. Which of the 12 apostles betrayed Jesus, leading to his arrest and crucifixion? Which of the 12 apostles betrayed Jesus, leading to his arrest and crucifixion? Question number four. Which actor played Den Watts, the first landlord of the Queen Vic in EastEnders? Which actor played Den Watts, the first landlord of the Queen Vic in EastEnders? Question number five. What part of the body is affected by glaucoma? What part of the body is affected by glaucoma? Question number six. What nut is used to make marzipan? What nut is used to make marzipan? Question number seven. In which wood was the Winnie the Pooh book set? In which wood was the Winnie the Pooh books set? Question number eight. Who had a number one hit in 1978 with the song I Will Survive? Who had a number one hit in 1978 with the song I Will Survive? Question number nine. Which planet is closest to the sun? Which planet is closest to the sun? Question number 10. In British politics, who is the leader of the Conservative Party? In British politics, who is the leader of the Conservative Party?
Thank you, Ian, for those brain teasers. Ian has supplied me with the answers, and I will be back with them later. Now, Richard Fawcett couldn't be here in person today, but has sent a characteristically playful item, which will be read for him by John King.
Thank you. Harvest. Three things come to mind. A hymn, said to remain one of the most popular in the UK, Flora Thompson's Lark Rise to Candleford, and Dickens' A Christmas Carol. The hymn, published in 1782 by German Matthias Claudius and set to music by Joanne Schultz and then translated in English by Jane Montgomery Campbell in 1861 is, and you can all join in, We plough the fields and scatter the good seed on the land, and it is fed and watered by God's almighty hand. With its chorus beginning, All good gifts around us, our send from heaven above. The hymn is cheerful, if not actually jaunty, in its melody and a rhythm, and seems to suggest that the human side of fieldwork is a bit of a doddle. This is not how Flora Thompson sees it in Lark Rise. Writing as an adult, but about her childhood in Oxfordshire and Northampton border, where she was born in 1876, the chapter Men Afield tells of fieldwork still mostly done by traditional methods. The elders stooped, gnarled and swollen hands and walked badly, for they felt the effects of life spent out of doors in all weathers, and of the rheumatism which tried most of them. This is apart from the torment of pulling on leather boots or shirts, dried all night in the fender after soaking in bitter weather. Her sense of literary back-breaking toil of peasant life is found too in the painting of Millet currently on exhibition at the National Gallery and of Van Gogh. Our hymn writers also differ significantly from the Bible in another way. Scripture also uses reaping and harvesting to refer to the not always happy consequences of human actions, using phrases now very much in everyday use even, or especially in secular context. So in the New Testament epistle to Galatians chapter 6, we read, "Whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he reap," with an added caution that any rewards for goodness may be slow in coming. And let us not be weary in well-doing, for the due season we shall reap if we faint not, where reaping refers to everlasting life, following favour with God. And in Hosea chapter 8, Old Testament, "For they have sown the wind, and they shall reap the whirlwind." Finally, in A Christmas Carol, with this archetypal miser, Scrooge, I refer you to a line in which Scrooge uses the image of harvest to describe Christmas. "Harvest time for the moneylender. And don't we still hear complaints that the birth of Christ has become too focused on money?" But when I looked in my copy to check the context of the line and failed to find it, I went online and found numerous results under The Muppet Christmas Carol, which I still consider to be the greatest film ever, in every way, not least, of course, the storyline.
Thank you, Richard. "We Plough the Fields and Scatter," one of my favourite infant school hymns, does rather skip over the gnarled hands and bent backs. Hard lives often rewarded by an all-too-soon visitation from the Grim Reaper. There is another aspect, though, once the work is done, which we will come to later. For now, though, thanks also to John King for that splendid rendition. Thank you. Now, after all that hard work, time for a tea, or should I say coffee break, with a piece by Toby Jacobs, read by Ken Watkins.
One Lump or Two, Frothy Coffee and the Birth of British Youth Culture. When one thinks of some of the various youth movements over the years, it is easy to forget sometimes that they all had to start somewhere. The Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco, California, will always be remembered as the place where the hippie seeds were first sown. The burnt-out ghetto of the South Bronx in New York City is officially recognised as the birthplace of hip-hop. The steel city of Sheffield, although most widely known for its cutlery, became equally famous in the 1980s for its new musical sound of synthesizer pop. And who would have thought that some of the main protagonists of the punk movement, with its spitting and snarling, came from the rather benign suburb of Bromley in Greater London? If there was ever an award for the most influential geographical area on British popular culture, it would have to be given to Soho, in the West End of London. This small maze of streets off Oxford Street has been the home to various waves of immigrants over the years, Maltese and Chinese. However, it was the Italians who populated this area to such an extent that it was named Little Italy. In their numerous cafes, they were instrumental in creating a different kind of environment that had previously not been seen. For they brought with them the first espresso coffee machines. These gargling, bellowing fountains of cool mesmerised the burgeoning youth, flush with disposable income. The newly emerging teenagers at last had somewhere they could call their own, away from the prying eyes of their parents. A world away from the traditional brown pubs, brown ale, and dad's tales of the war. This was theirs. Throw into the mix the latest sounds of American rock and roll, and you had a recipe for creativity that would launch a myriad of copycat pop acts, and ultimately, the UK's own version of Elvis. The coffee bar at the forefront of this new scene was called the Two Eyes in Old Compton Street. Named after its original owners, the Irani brothers, it had a tiny downstairs room with a stage no bigger than 18 inches wide. The new owners started booking local skiffle acts to play. Here, the likes of Tommy Steele, Hank Marvin, and the then unknown Harry Webb cut their teeth. Upstairs, the espresso flowed, and the cool kids thought their frothy coffee was the height of chic. Such an impact did this new coffee culture have that a rather cheesy film was made in 1959 called Espresso Bongo. It starred the aforementioned Harry Webb, now known as Cliff Richard. By 1964, the new sounds of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles meant that the Two Eyes had seen its peak come and go. It closed in 1967. Meanwhile, not far away in Fifth Street, another coffee bar, Bar Italia, was fast becoming the hangout for the latest youth movement of the time, the mods. Everything about Italian culture appealed to the new modernists, from the slim-cut suits to the Vespa and Lambretta scooters. Nearby clubs such as The Scene and The Flamingo played all the latest R&B sounds that the kids craved. Soho, yet again, was at the forefront of cool. They say that for every action, there is a reaction, and in the case of the mods, this was the Rockers. Also known as the Tun-Up Boys, because of their penchant for riding their motorbikes at 100 miles an hour, they were the antithesis of Latin style. They eschewed any form of preening and aimed to look as oily and as greasy as possible. They were seen as archaic and agricultural by the mods, and this led to the infamous seaside clashes between the two tribes. The spiritual home of the 60s London biker was the Ace Cafe on the North Circular Road. Essentially a transport cafe, it offered a meeting place for the leather-clad speeders. The coffee flowed here too, but I'm not sure if any of them admitted to it being frothy. There's an apocryphal tale that a 45 RPM single was played on the jukebox, and the aim was to drive up to the next junction on the A406 and back before it came to an end. Ah, those were the days. Going into an identikit Starbucks and ordering an extra hot skinny latte just doesn't seem as exciting anymore.
Thank you, Toby, for a fact-packed trip through the coffee, pop and style culture of the late 50s and 60s. Perfectly crafted and informative as ever. Thank you too to Ken Watkins for reading. And now, Margaret King brings our attention to another aspect of harvest altogether.
I suppose that the definition of harvest goes something like this. The collection of the bounty of the earth from land and sea in order to be stored, processed, and ultimately used. When late summer and autumn arrive in this country, we all harvest in various small ways, such as picking blackberries or wild plums, maybe from the wayside hedges and trees. But some may be the lucky owners of pear, apple and plum trees, which this year I have noticed are very well laden. I imagine a longer time and a greater effort is needed here to pick them carefully. However, I expect it is the grain harvest which most readily springs to mind when the word harvest is mentioned, at least to those of us who live in East Anglia. Travel overseas and it could be a very different story. Read Tom Lake, the latest novel by the American author Anne Patchett, and we learn a great deal about the harvest of cherries, which grow in abundance in northern Michigan. But back here it's grain. As the harvest hymn goes, we plough the fields and scatter the good seed on the ground. Our house is adjacent to an arable farm. From our bedroom, I can look down upon a large field of golden corn. Well, it's wheat this year, but often barley, and occasionally rape. The farmer's fields stretch before me, over to the horizon, where they blend into woods and other fields. A beautiful vista, to be sure. I look to the left and see a collection of barns, fronted by a large grassed area, on which appear, at regular intervals, very expensive items of farming machinery, such as tractors, drills, sprays, harrows, and, of course, at this time of the year, an absolutely enormous state-of-the-art combine harvester, used by the farmer to cut his own fields and also for contract cutting in the vicinity. Huge container trucks arrive any time during the day, evening, or very early morning to take and transport the grain. Even the dogs have got used to these activities and fail to bark anymore. This is the face of modern harvesting, technically advanced, but still long hours and hard work. Go back in time and we see other pictures. As a child, I can recall the practice of gleaning when, unlike today, the cutting machines left a fair amount of grain on the ground. We gathered it to feed to a couple of scrawny hens who pecked away morosely in the backyard. Harvest has long been associated with Thanksgiving and celebration. Church harvest festivals were legend. The buildings decorated profusely, stone shelves practically groaning under the weight of apples, carrots and potatoes. The focal point, a beautifully baked loaf on the altar and fashioned in the shape of a sheaf of wheat. Congregations in those days would bring, as gifts, fruit and vegetable produce from their own gardens and allotments. A day or so later, sumptuous harvest suppers followed, and the gifts were auctioned off to raise funds for the church. Well, at least that's how I remember it, maybe too romantically. Today's festivals, well decorated as they are, don't seem quite the same, and the gifts of tinned baked beans, spaghetti hoops and packets of pasta, resembling nothing more than the store banks in every supermarket, are distressingly familiar. Where has the charisma gone? Nevertheless, I am pleased that harvest festivals are still annual occurrences and are often followed by a celebratory meal. In fact, I was pleasantly surprised to notice that this year, Stansted Church held a Lammas celebration, which is an ancient rural festival to bless the early harvest of grain. We attended this open-air service and afterwards partook in a simple bread, cheese and wine supper, the bread being the loaf mass, or Lammas loaf, which had been made with wheat flour from a local farmer's field. In conclusion, let's go back to the mid-1800s to a master storyteller and discover some truly atmospheric harvest festivities. In his novel Far From the Madding Crowd, Thomas Hardy portrays harvest as a time of hard work, camaraderie and celebration. The harvest supper and dance, which features heavily in the book and in the filmed versions, marks a pivotal point in the story. For as the community comes together, tensions and conflicts simmer beneath the surface. As farmer and shepherd Gabriel Oak approaches the barn, Hardy writes, "He hears sounds of violins and a tambourine and the regular jigging of many feet, which herald it the harvest supper and dance. Garlands of green foliage decorated the walls and beams, and on a rostrum sat three fiddlers and a frantic man, perspiration streaming down his cheeks and a tambourine quivering in his hand." At this very point, whilst thunder rumbles outside, threatening a downpour to completely ruin the carefully harvested wheat and barley ricks, Sergeant Troy decides to serve treble strong goblets of brandy and water to the farmhands, to the men used only to drinking ale and cider. To discover the nigh-on disastrous events which ensue, you must consult the film, or better still, read or listen to the book. Happy harvest to you all.
Thank you, Margaret. Harvest Festival was a much looked forward to feature of my young, very young school days, and you capture the joy of it well. I feel as though it's a somewhat forgotten festival these days that should be more widely celebrated. Harvest comes closer to home now, as Ken Watkins shares the ups and downs of tending allotments and garden vegetable patches.
I was talking to a neighbour recently who has an allotment here in Barry. She's a lot younger than me, so can still look after the plot without too much suffering the next day. While she was extolling the delights of growing and eating your own, she said that this year had been something of a mixed blessing. While most of her vegetables and fruit had done reasonably well, the staple of potatoes was proving much more of a challenge. Despite praying every night for rain, and regularly watering everything as, contrary to rumour, Wales isn't always wet, the ground is rock hard in places. Trying to dig up a few potatoes that weekend meant she had to soak the area first. The delicious potatoes were a little small, she said, but well worth the effort. I've never had an allotment, but have been fortunate enough, in some places we've lived, to have enjoyed a large plot of land suitable for growing our own veg. And apart from the occasional difficult year, always enjoyed the delights and challenges of working the land. We bought our first house in 1969 in Belper, Derbyshire, having watched it being built. Inevitably, being a new build, both the front and rear gardens were left in need of a lot of TLC. The front was easy, grass seed and a few plants made the house look lived in, but the rear garden, quite long, sloped. With the help of some friends, over time we managed to get it to three levels, and while we worked on the first one, nearest the house, potatoes were planted in the other two. Very successfully, I'm glad to say, and more than enough to share with the friends who helped. The third level became the permanent veg plot. Sadly, I left behind what looked a promising crop on that level, as the offer of a better job meant we moved. Having learned our lesson, the next house we purchased was established, albeit only a few years old, a bungalow on the edge of the village of Eccleston in Lancashire. It was next to open country, fields which had horses roaming free. A regular supply of healthy manure was just the other side of the fence. So the vegetable patch at the side of the house benefited enormously from these animals, and apart from one extremely hot year, everything grew well. The plot wasn't big enough to feed a family of four all year round, so we supplemented by getting supplies from a farm shop, which was on my way home from work. The farm was on fertile land reclaimed from the sea, and the vegetables and potatoes were lovely. To stop raiding birds, I put protective netting over various crops, but somehow the peas kept getting eaten. I was puzzled for a while until the day I was working on the plot, and one of our dachshunds sauntered in, used her nose to lift the netting over the peas, and started munching. The following day, I installed a gate. But the biggest and most rewarding challenge came when we lived in Suffolk. After 14 years in Acton, we moved to Alpheaton, and a cottage which had 2.5 acres of land. Many years earlier, the family kept pigs and chickens as well as growing veg. Changes of ownership saw the land divided into paddocks, with a small stable block in the largest for three horses, very different from anything we'd had before. We took a practical approach and rented out the land to someone needing somewhere to stable a couple of horses. That lasted a few years, but we soon found another happy customer with a horse, a Shetland pony and a donkey. Two paddocks taken care of while we looked after the others. And we invested in a ride-on mower for the times when the stable block was empty. We purchased a large polytunnel, and every year but one of the 12 years we lived there, the harvest from that was excellent. Some of it even won prizes in the annual village show. We kept chickens. There were apple trees and blackberry bushes, and we invited our neighbours to pick their own. I occasionally came home to find one of them harvesting the fruit, but I did get invited, on several occasions, to sample one neighbour's apple and blackberry pies, delicious payment in kind. It really was the good life, but it was hard work, and after retiring we downsized to a much smaller plot in the village. Life suddenly became a lot easier, as there was only enough room to grow some strawberries. They thrived, and as we brought some plants with us when we moved to Wales, those delicious Suffolk strawberries are still thriving.
Thank you, Ken. I'm full of admiration for garden vegetable growers. The patience, perseverance and faith involved, not to mention the hard work, all for such uncertain results. Now, as promised, the answers to those quiz questions. Number one. Helsinki is the capital city of Finland. Ben Stokes plays cricket for England. Judas Iscariot was the apostle who betrayed Jesus, leading to his arrest and crucifixion. Number four. Leslie Grantham played Den Watts as the first landlord of the Queen Vic in EastEnders. The part of the body affected by glaucoma are the eyes. Number six. Almonds are used to make marzipan. Number seven. The wood in Winnie the Pooh books was 100 acre wood, where they played poo sticks over a bridge. Number eight, it was Gloria Gaynor who had that unforgettable hit song in 1978, I Will Survive. Number nine, Mercury is a planet closest to the sun. And number 10, the leader of the Conservative Party is Kemi Badenoch. So, did you do well? Answers on a postcard, please. Our final piece today comes from Jackie McSweeney, who adds yet another dimension to the meaning of harvest.
Thank you. Harvest. Hello, everyone. I can't believe the year is racing by so quickly. It barely seemed a few days ago we were basking in sunshine, hoping for rain to feed the bare earth. And now we want the rain to stop, as it means the leaves will all turn brown and winter will be here by Tuesday. For now, though, it's that time of year for the harvest, and I ask myself, what does harvest mean to me? If you were ever a fan of The Young Ones, that anarchic comedy in the 1980s, you may remember Neil, the long-haired hippie who said, "Well, man," all the time. One of my favourite quotes was from Neil with Rick in the garden. Neil was completely animated for a change and said, "Well, man, we sow the seed, nature grows the seed, then we eat the seed, then we sow the seed, nature grows the seed, and we eat the seed," he went on for a bit. "The timeless wonder of it." And that's all true, and basically how it happens. Ever since I was a little girl, our family was encouraged to grow vegetables and pick free fruit from the trees and bushes. My older brother would go scrumping, and my mum used to take us pea picking for apples or blackcurrants or potatoes in the school holidays. Of course, we'd sneak a bag of the produce out on the bus to take us home and cook it. When I settled with my husband, he too had an interest in growing veg, as you can't beat the flavour of freshly picked crops. This started small, a few spuds from the ones that went to seed and a few tomato plants. As time went on, we moved to Sudbury. We managed to secure an allotment in Bilderston. It was a bit of a drive, but worth it, a huge plot with water supply adjacent. Andy had bought an old rotavator, which he managed to get going, and we got it into the trailer. It did a great job. Many a year we enjoyed the fruits of our harvest, as well as numerous family, friends and neighbours. We joined the waiting list for an allotment in Sudbury and moved to that plot well over 20 years ago. So many happy times there together. Him digging, cutting and keeping the grass edges in order. Me sowing, weeding, harvesting the goodies and then being creative. Because what comes with every harvest? Yep, a glut. What do you do with a glut, eh? I've tried and succeeded with most of the following. 1. Sauce it up. I turn extra tomatoes or courgettes and patty pan into a pasta sauce, salsa or curry base. I then freeze it for lazy day meals. 2. Pickle party. I've dabbled with pickled cucumbers, my favourite. Runner beans, maybe not. And beetroot, lovely with a bit of chilli. Instant crunchy snacks. 3. Chutney. I make chutney every year and I become more imaginative and productive. I really enjoy giving them as homemade Christmas presents to family and friends. I thought I was inflicting them, but now I'm getting requests. So chili and tomato jam is this year's new try. It tasted pretty good as I was pouring it into the jars. 4. Freeze for the future. Most successful freeze is broad beans. The trick is not to blanch for too long, and it's lovely to then make broad bean hummus when I want, or just eat them as they are with a meal. 5. Donate the goodness. Food banks, shelters or community fridges will love your fresh produce. I just pop mine on the wall at the front of the house, free to take. They always go. Harvest also teaches us lessons beyond agriculture. In many cultures, harvest is more than just about food. It's a symbol of hard work paying off, of patience rewarded, and of community coming together. In a way, we are all planting seeds in our daily lives through our efforts at school, work, relationships, or personal growth. The harvest is the outcome of those seeds, the skills we gain, the friendships we nurture, the goals we achieve. At the same time, harvest reminds us to be mindful. Not every year brings a perfect crop. There can be setbacks, challenges, and lean times. Yet, even in smaller harvests, there is something to be grateful for. So whether we're talking about fields of wheat, orchards of fruit, or the harvests of our own lives, this season invites us to pause, to celebrate what has grown, and to share generously with others. If you think about your own life, what's the seed you've been planting? Something you've been working on? That you hope to harvest soon? I really hope you enjoy your harvests and have your wow man moments of delight. Thank you.
Thank you, Jackie, for bringing this month's proceedings to a close with bounty and thoughtfulness. A lovely contribution to the magazine. Well, this edition has been a real celebration of what harvest means to our volunteers and to our guest John Pawsey, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. My thanks to all for their contributions, to our technician Trevor Green, and to you for listening. Until next time, goodbye.